You're listening to Renegade Broadcasting.
Welcome to another edition of Never So Defined and Proud on Renegade Broadcasting with your host Chris. Today I have Heathen Vegan to talk about a great many subjects. We will be starting off by talking about Stonehenge. Hello Heathen Vegan, welcome.
Hello there Chris, good to be here man.
What do you think is the relevance of Stonehenge to us today?
Well, that's a big question to start with, but yeah, I mean, Stonehenge is the most famous, probably one of the most famous archaeological sites on the planet. There's very few sites that are as well known as Stonehenge. It's probably had more archaeological digs than anywhere else. It's been the fascination of many, a curious mind over the centuries. Obviously, what we see today with Stonehenge is just, it's a rebuild. It was slightly in bad repair.
And this was in the 1950s, wasn't it? 1953?
Yeah, that was the big rebuild that we see today, yeah, in the 1950s. There's some interesting photos that people might have seen of them digging in the 1950s. I've never really got to the bottom of that. There's lots of conspiracy around it, but trying to find the actual... I mean, it looks like they were repairing them and putting them back up, but we do know that how it looks today... the reconstruction as it looks today is probably out. As people are probably very familiar, the henge is made of up two upright stones with a cross beam stone in circles that go round a circle. And then inside you've got the same design but in a horseshoe shape. It does appear that the horseshoe shape, though, would have been a completed circle.
So were the stones put in the same place, or did they, I mean, how much care did they put into reconstructing or not?
They look like they're in the right place. Like I say, they left out some stones, which I have heard, and it seems semi-well documented that they just buried the stones that didn't fit. So there was obviously more to it, whether that was deliberate fudging of the history of Stonehenge or just people, you know, bad repairmen. I mean, that's open to speculation, but it does. How it appears today is probably not how it looked back then. There was obviously, it was in quite bad repair system.
So what is Stonehenge to you, Heathen Vegan?
In a sense of just how I feel, well, it's an interesting place, but I think there's a lot of emphasis put on it, considering there are literally hundreds of these all over Britain. I think in Aberdeenshire alone, just for an example, there are over 100 stone monuments of some type, that be stone circles, cairns, you know, or just standing stones as they are on their own, as you get sometimes. But obviously, because Stonehenge has got is so famous worldwide, there's been a lot of documentaries on it, a lot of speculation about it. Obviously, it was reconstructed. There's a lot of evidence to show that the reconstruction is actually wrong. It's probably the most famous monument, probably in the world, actually. There's not many monuments more famous than Stonehenge. Everybody knows about it, but there's not that much known about it, really, archaeologically. Although it is probably one of the most extensively dug. It's had more archaeological digs there than probably nearly any site in the world, actually. I think the official dating on it is probably about 3000 BC, but that's not the stones. They believe that there was a wooden henge first. This is similar with a lot of the stone circles in Britain.
What is the mainstream explanation of what Stonehenge was meant to be, and what do you think that it was meant to be?
It actually goes back to about 8,000 BC. The first evidence of anything there, like I say, is the most, probably one of the biggest fascinations of modern, semi-modern archaeology on the globe. So it's had a lot of digs there. They did find some post holes there, I think only about four, from about 8,000 BC, but that's 10,000 years ago. So that's very old. I mean, now, the thing to mention about Stonehenge is there are actually many stone circles all over Western Europe, actually, but especially Britain. Stone circles, stone monuments. And many are still in disrepair. Many have just been overlooked completely, most of them. Aberdeenshire, for instance, just to give you the scale of how many there are, Aberdeenshire is one of the most highly dense areas in Britain. And that has over 100 stone monuments, whether it be circles, megaliths, just single standing stones or cairns, etc., etc. But as Stonehenge is the most dug, they found very early evidence. But all the reason I mentioned that the other stuff was because there's probably very early evidence of the other ones as well, but they've just never been dug, or they're really in bad state of repair, most of them. People don't seem to care about these ancient monuments. But back to Stonehenge, about 8,000 BC, we get the first things being built there. Obviously, there's very little information there archaeologically.
That's in mainstream dating methods.
Yeah, and these would have been wooden. It would have been made of wood at this time. Definitely not stones. But yeah, mainstream. Mm. I mean, we have a lot of problems with dating because although we can dig the layers, Stonehenge is a great example of this, how it's changed over the centuries, over the millennia. We know that they've moved stones. We know that they've put different stones in at different times. We know that sometimes there was wooden. Some people, even early on, actually, early in the, when people were first looking at Stonehenge, they actually believed it was roofed. That idea has faded away slowly, and people don't believe it's roofed now. But some people still say that it was roofed because, and the stones were in the center of a wooden roofed enclosure. But obviously, there's no evidence of the roof. So it was made of wood and it's high up. I mean, we've got the post holes, but obviously people are just saying now that the post holes were just freestanding, freestanding wooden posts, not actually roofed. But you're not going to get evidence for the roof archaeologically, sadly. It's well rot. If there was a roof on it 8,000 BC, it's well rotted away now. You know what I mean?
There's a lot of focus on particular places, and Stonehenge takes a lot of that focus. Do you think that this focus on Stonehenge takes away from other sites?
To a degree. I mean, the site itself is very important. I mean, there are a lot of things that are in the area that, you know, you've got Longbarrow tombs, you've got other henges. All around Stonehenge, like you said, because it is so well documented and so well dug, they've dug in the surrounding areas and they found lots of things. I do believe that you would find this probably in the other areas too. It's just they're not as, you know, they, I mean, like I said before, that some of them are literally dilapidated. Nobody
well,
cares
would you, yeah, would you suggest that Stonehenge has a particular significance, that it has a particular importance, perhaps even more important than other places, or maybe that's the wrong way to see it. Maybe we can't know that, or maybe it's because people now put more of an emphasis on Stonehenge because it's been pushed.
Been pushed, for sure, but I think it takes away a lot of the focus, like I say, from the other places. And I think they like that because people just think Stonehenge. I mean, it wasn't until quite recently that I've got into looking at these stone monuments as part of my ancestral past, you know, as I look into a lot of aspects of it. I mean, obviously I knew about them and I'd watched documentaries about it when I was younger and things, but it's only very recently that I've really started to look at them as something more important. And I was astounded when I found out how many there were. I mean, so I think it does keep us thinking that it's, most people might just think it's very unique by the over-focus on it and no focus on anything else. So I think it's so well known that they can't hide it, you know, it's there.
Well, there's so a major road that goes by it. Yeah, you can see it from this major road. So it has a lot of focus towards it. And of course, then you have all of these groups that go there to worship it. So, and that even that has become fairly degenerate. So, and it's also very near to Glastonbury. So it's interesting that it's been pushed.
Yeah, I mean, Glastonbury, as you know, Chris, from living in the UK, and maybe people that out would know about Glastonbury, it's got a lot of new age type people there now because of its historic relevance. But again, it's a very well-documented site, unlike other areas. But I mean, it is a good example of the stuff because there's so much archaeological digs there. It does give us an insight into what's probably occurring in these other places. I mean, most people don't know that most of these stone circles are surrounded by a ditch, which would have at the time been full of water. Most people don't even know there's a ditch. But if you look at Avebury, for example, I mean, the ditch is very clear there. And because the water table was different then, it would have naturally filled with water. They wouldn't have had to fill it. It would naturally have water. So there's, for example, as well, with Stonehenge, some of the very early stuff where it was mostly wooden posts, there was enclosures within it as well. We know there were enclosures within it from archaeological digs. So there's a lot of the history of Stonehenge is not just like some people put stones up and that was it. Even when you go back to later, like early Bronze Age, because, I mean, obviously, even when the stones were put up was around, I think, 2000, just before the Bronze Age. With the dating, it's very hard because... Yeah, we can date the soil and the pollen, and this is how they date it with carbon dating, if you fully trust that, which I don't. But even with that, we know that these sites have been moved around, like I said. So what you end up with is, if they keep digging and moving around, these soil layers are being mixed a little bit. So I'm not 100% sure how they can be so accurate with the dating on these things. Sometime around 2600, I think they put the stones in, 2600 BC. I mean, I could be wrong on that date, but around then. But yeah, so they weren't just stones put up. There was a lot of activity. So we're talking 2600 BC. We're talking nearly 6,000 years of wooden posts before the stone posts. And then after that, even in the early Bronze Age, so the stones have been up now for 1,000 odd years, people are still burying people there or around it. Now there is an interesting thing, because there are relationships to burial and birth in these places.
So what do you think the stones would have looked like back when they were put up?
It's very hard to know. I believe that it would have been... there would have been two circles. An inner circle, an outer circle, and there would have been a ditch around it. I mean, another interesting thing that I haven't found the root of this yet, but it's interesting, this is built on chalk. And when through research in different areas of the Neolithic and early Bronze Age, chalk was a very important substance to build these things on. Whether it be... barrows, obviously, like Uffington Horse is the chalk and the chalk man. There's lots of chalk is very important to them. And obviously chalk is white. But I need to look into the chemical composition of chalk and see what it does energetically and things, just to see why they're using chalk. But they do seem to prefer to build these things on chalk. So you would have probably had two circles, an inner and outer, in the stone period, with at least one. You'd probably had a water ditch dug that was full of water, and probably a bank as well, maybe.
The stones would have been smooth, would they not? I mean, they would have been worn away over time.
They'd have probably been worked, yeah, to look a little bit better. I mean, it's hard to tell because obviously they're made out of the blue stones. They're very hard stones, so they don't actually deteriorate that much, even over thousands of years. You're talking probably a few mil, but yeah, they may have looked better than they are now. It's hard to tell exactly how they would have looked though, if they'd have smooth polished them or not. But I mean, it's something I'm not fully aware of.
I went to that area a few years ago, and I had a guide. The group of us had a guide, and she was telling us that the stones would have been smooth.
No, it's possible. Know. Like I say, because there's been a few millimetres of wear. So if you'd done any working on them, it would be lost now. But yeah, they could have. I'm sure they would have worked them. Like I say, the history of Stonehenge, though, for me, goes back before the stones. It's obviously a very religious site, specific to, I believe, births and deaths. But
also, she was saying that the stones had fallen into disrepair in the past and been forgotten about. There would have been forest grown around it at one point. Do you think that they could have been forgotten about in the past?
They obviously were, because they were in such disrepair.
Well, that could be modern times.
It depends what we're clarifying as modern. I mean, you've got, for example, from Christianity you're talking, which is still over 1,000 years ago, they would have probably started into disrepair. But so that's a very long time. Do you know what I mean?
Good point. Yeah.
So how long have they been in disrepair? It's probably hard to tell because, you know, after 1,000 years, I mean, you're going to have a lot of, you know, a forest can grow in 1,000 years. So how long ago was it before then? I don't know. I mean, there's lots of details. I mean, I'm sure there is archaeological evidence that will tell us exactly when the forest started growing. I haven't looked into Stonehenge particularly that much to know that. I've read quite a bit about it, but the information is probably there if you want to find it. Like I say, my concern is on a wider scale because there's so many of them, and they're so interesting. Because why were they built? I mean, I've said this before about other things, but it's the effort involved in some of these things. You've got early Neolithic builders building across waterways, like I've said before on other shows, and they're using literally like 50,000 logs. It would have took massive amount of effort to build these places. Our look at their ancestors was that they were just, you know, doing random stuff and just basically surviving. But this shows a lot of free time, extra time that they had to invest in very meticulous planning of things.
Well, they had time to do things their own way. They didn't have all of these distractions like we have now, and they had...
I believe that they built things for purpose. And I mean this in a very specific way. Not just like they built a building big enough to house if they wanted to store wood in it, right? They built the building by measurements and everything to do with what they were using it for. I watched something recently. It was quite interesting, actually. And it was talking how some of the very early churches, measurements correspond to sound, just to try and put it in a context. And by this, if you just imagine like an organ at a church, right? Depending on the length that the tube is cut to, depends on its note, the note that it plays. Now, I'm no musician, so I couldn't tell you all about the notes, but if you cut a length of tube at a foot and attach it to an organ or make it so you can play it as an instrument, it will make a certain sound. That sound corresponds to hertz, yeah? So, and then from that, you can get a measurement. So a foot equals this sound, or a foot equals that note. Now, when you're building a building that someone's going to be singing a certain key or a certain note, you can actually use the measurements that sound is in cutting tube to directly relate it to the building. So everything's a multiplication of that. And there was a church, I forget its name now, because I recently watched this documentary, not a documentary, so it was a talk by this very old guy, very interesting talk, where he was saying that this man, quite a long time ago, did the measurements of a church, a very old church, and found that it corresponded to the sounds the type of singing that they were doing in the church at the time. So they built the church to literally resonate with the person. So when you're singing at that note and in those frequencies, that the whole building would be resonating with it because it's built of multiples of that sound. I don't know if that was clear enough for you. Sorry, the guy that I was listening to. No,
makes complete sense. I think that they were very much in tune with their environments and every aspect of their world. And
yeah, I think so. What I'm trying to say is, when they built something, it had specific purpose, and there was intent going into that—not just intent, mental intent, or meditative intent, like the. You know, you'll get a lot of with the New Age stuff. It's all about intention through the mind. That is important, but it's also physical intention. They're actually doing as they intend. So everything was built meticulously for a purpose. And they would put massive effort into this, not because they're doing it for no reason, because I think it must have given them some benefit later. I mean, they were living in very harsh conditions. So to put this much effort into making things exact, I mean, we know that sound frequency was probably important in Stonehenge, especially if it was roofed early on. But we know from, you know, many monuments, even like the pyramids in Giza, we know that they're acoustic, you know, they're perfect for singing in or making certain chants and things. And this happens in Britain too.
We know the effect on water that certain vibrations can have. So You've spoken about water in the past,
yes,
with multiple examples of how our ancestors related to it in terms of the gods, in terms of directly with water in their environments, living on water, even the language. I mean, do you want to just quickly talk about the language and maybe Odin?
Yeah, well, I mean, well, even in this case, people, like I said at the beginning, there was ditches around that would have had water in them. Most of these stone circles have these. But it's an aspect that people don't see today because the water table has changed, so there's no longer standing water in them. I mean, the best example of this is obviously Avebury. That's a much bigger stone circle, by the way, than Stonehenge. There's literally a village built in it, as you'll know, Chris, but...
Well, the thing with Avebury is it had been found afterwards. It wasn't really accepted as being such. And yeah, exactly. They even built a road through it. So this is one reason why I think that Stonehenge is a distraction, because they need to have people's focus on, you know, away from other areas, because evidence will turn up, and of course people want to know about the past, and they need to have somewhere for their mind to go when they think about all this. So to have Stonehenge as a place where people can think, you know, oh, that's one of our ancient monuments, and then their mind doesn't really wander much further, because that's what is getting promoted, and maybe there'll be one or two other places for others who maybe think a little bit further, you know, like the White Horse or something else. There are other monuments, and the reason that other places have been, that we know about them, is because people who actually care have kept the memory of them alive, restored them. But it's not necessarily because, you know, the powers that be want that. But perhaps with Stonehenge, they did use that as a distraction.
Yeah, I mean, take, for example, Cornwall, just to go off a little bit here. But Cornwall, it's in England, I do believe it's got the most of these stone circles, stone monuments, whatever you want to call them. There are a lot that are well documented. There are a lot that people are not even sure if they are them anymore, because the stones are in such disrepair, you know, they're scattered around. But people take the emphasis off Cornwall. Now, Cornwall's massively involved in the Bronze Age of the whole of Europe. A lot of people don't understand this. Some people have estimated that over 90% of all the tin that because to make bronze, you need copper and tin. About 90% of all the tin in the Bronze Age of Europe, the whole of Europe, this is all the Greek Bronze Age stuff, and everywhere else was came from Cornwall. So that would make Cornwall a seriously important place. And at this around this time, there are still monuments going up, and there are a lot of monuments there beforehand. There's been recent discoveries that have actually pushed the Bronze Age in Europe is generally seen to be quite late. But there has been some recent discoveries, I think, in Eastern Europe that have pushed it back to maybe even being earlier than the Bronze Age in the Middle East or the, you know, the Eastern Steppes. Because the Bronze Age in Britain, I believe, is said to be about 2100 BC-ish starts. It's pretty much the date for most of Europe, give or take, you know, a few hundred years here and there. But there's something that could push it back a few thousand years found in Eastern Europe somewhere. I forgot where now, sorry, because it was a recent thing I looked up. And this is quite recently found. And that involved tin. I don't know if they've done any analysis on the tin yet, though, to see if it came from Cornwall, which would be interesting. But, yeah, Cornwall's a massively important place. And there's loads of monuments there that get little to no attention at all. Some are very far off the beaten track, so it's very hard to get to them. You can't drive a car. They're on the moors and places like that. So we don't know much about them. I mean, probably people have heard about the megalithic yard, which is, I think it was a guy called Tom, his last name, who devised that they were standardized. Although modern archaeology does not accept this at all, there is a lot of evidence to show that they were, and that was related to the sound, actually. Because the metric system is just about measurement, where it seems that the older system with feet and inches, well, I say older system for us in England but and Europe, although we still use it. We use the metric system too. In America, obviously, you still use feet and inches, I believe. But these older measurements were much more to do with a more holistic measuring, like I said before, with the example of the church. So the building was an intended purpose. Say, is it a distraction? Probably, but I mean, it's still interesting. We can still learn a lot because we can apply what we learn here to other places. And I know a lot of people don't like modern archaeology, but yeah, their dating might be off and things, but there are still things dug and we can still get a lot of information from it. We just have to look at it slightly differently. They don't even accept some of the ideas of solar alignments and things of these circles. I mean, although most people listen to this will think that that is accepted fact. A lot of modern archaeology doesn't, or they give it very crude alignments, like, oh, it just marked the sunrise or something, when there was much more going on. I mean, I think another thing to understand about these is, though, that the stone circles and stone monuments were definitely multi-purpose because of the amount of effort that was put in them. This is why the actual roofed idea has a lot of ground, because it looks like at a time when the birth of the priestly class, maybe, which is something that's not talked about too much, but that it could have been a time when they'd got their growing and agriculture up to a very high level. And they started having people that could dedicate themselves to maybe more spiritual aspects. So that would be the birth of the spiritual class, which, or the religious class, however you want to call it, that would have had a major effects on these communities. People could start to observe the stars more and look into things more.
Would that be some kind of spiritually based caste system?
It could have been the birth of that. I mean, that was one of the theories that come with the roof theory. It was like the early 1900s, maybe like 1800s, that they believed that Stonehenge may have been roofed with wooden roof and wooden pillars. That's what they believe that they had, because they believe that there was an outer wooden posts that they believe would have roofed it, and earlier structures. The early ideas on that was that this was the birth of a priestly class because of them beginning to master agriculture. But there is some evidence, actually, suggesting that these places have a lot to do with the increase in ability in agriculture. There was an interesting study done in South America by these guys that were writing about them. And they did it with the South American monuments, you know, like the Inca monuments, etc., or what are said to be Inca monuments, but some people believe they're older, etc., where they actually put some indigenous corn seeds on these monuments. And then they took them back, and in a controlled environment, they planted the ones that they put on the monument, and they planted ones that hadn't been put on the monument. And they got something like a 40% increase in germination rate or something. It could even be more than that. I might be underestimating that because I can't remember the exact numbers. But it was a massive increase in germination. I mean, you've got Emoto, yeah. His connection with water, which are interesting, although I think they're a little bit trivial. Although the implications are big, but they're kind of trivialized mostly. For instance, I mean, bless water, right? Christians do it, you know, at the font. They bless the water or they bless something. That's intention-based. And this is probably where baptism came from. Blessing of water that you put on a child's head. Not as a ceremony for Christianity. There is some evidence, although it is tenuous with Druids doing some sort of baptism. But there is a massive connection religiously, obviously, with water. Like you mentioned, we built our houses on water, marshlands, or sometimes rivers directly. We built our dwellings on them. A great effort, I might add.
Christianity had to take aspects of our ancient cultures and, well, yes, twist them. There's a lot to suggest that we had quite a great connection to water and a lot to suggest why that would be. Yeah, as you were saying about Emoto there seems to be something very powerful with water. In fact, that it may contain memory in itself.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's how homeopathy works, isn't it? Your memory of water, essentially. You put one drop in a vial, and then you mix it up, and then you put that vial, one drop of that vial in another 100 vials, and you just keep doing it. So there's like literally nothing left but this air. The water remembers the structure of what was in it. Therefore, you can take things that would be a lethal dose as a smaller dose, as well as modern science would say is a non-existent dose. So there's lots of aspects of water and memory. And we get this in Norse mythology. Mimir's well, right? It's the well of memory. Mimir is literally etymologically connected to memory. It's where we get the word memory from. Well, it's not where we get the word memory from, but we get the word Mimir from. It doesn't really matter which one came first or which way around they are. They both relate to memory, and that's related to water. And I've wrote about this a little bit. Woden sacrifices the eye for the water for a drink of Mimir as well. Now, I believe that was a ruse on Woden's part. Woden was actually very smart there with the sacrifice because he put his eye in the well. Okay, so he's got one eye on the past. Memory is the past. And one eye on the present, yeah? But there's the old saying about memory and having one eye on the past. And I think that was the purpose of that. Actually, I think there's a lot of significance in his eye being in the well. I mean, there's also interesting that Heimdall's ear is in the well too. There's suggestions of that as well in some of the sagas and the mythology surrounding the gods of the North. Which also, he can hear everything that goes on. Now, if you're in touch with memory, or the racial memory, or the racial consciousness, then you can see everything as it happens, just as it happened, which is great.
It could also speak to different senses. Like nowadays, we call it clairsentience or clairvoyance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. Seder, I think it's called, or Sefer. I'm not sure exactly how it's pronounced, but that was a magic practiced primarily by women, but also Woden practices it, which is the Norns practice it. And they're the weavers of fate, right? So and they live at the well, which Mimir's well and the well under Yggdrasil are very similar and probably represent the same concept, at least, as a memory, a past. And from the past, the Norns weave the future. So water and memory are intimately linked. And like I say, our ancestors, and we can trace this back to pre-humans, right? So, I mean, whatever you think of evolution, for example, Heidelbergensis is a pre-human. They believe came out of Homo erectus and turned into Neanderthal, but it turned into modern humans. It's a pre-human anyway. its exact connection can be debated by different people, but they, in a study done in Britain, they actually lived on water too. They were picking natural formations, so small islands they were living on, inland islands I'm talking about. This practice goes back, if we trace it back to them, 600,000 years. And these are pre-humans. Like I say, people have different ideas on exactly how humans got here, whether we were put here, whether we evolved or whatever. But evolution is not quite what people think anyway. But even modern scientific evolution, it's not actually what the mainstream people believe. But it's about adapting or conscious adapting to an environment, which is slightly different to random mutation. But yeah, water goes back a long way. And obviously you have the bog burials. They're important. And if we, you know, if we go over to India, pre-Indo-Aryan, this is pre-Hinduism, pre where all Hinduism came from, and we go back to Harappan culture, we know that they worship water because of the amount of wells that they had. And I mean, I've talked about this briefly before, and I believe that that culture is directly linked to Western Europe through many aspects, the horned god being one of them. Cernunnos, as he's more well known in the West, or even the Green Man. A lot of people accept the Green Man as Cernunnos. But yeah, so water is a massively important aspect of our early spiritual beliefs and spiritual practices that has been, I mean, the Christians take, for example, wells, holy wells. We've all heard of holy wells. In England, if you live in a town, there's probably a local holy well, right? There's probably one that's relatively close that everybody knows about in that area. Then, you know, generally misunderstood right now. You know, nobody really cares about them. Christianity, they're called holy wells because they were taken over by Christianity as holy places for God. But there's little writing, and I mean really hardly anything written about them in prehistory. And we know that they were taken over. So these holy wells meant something spiritually and religiously to our ancient ancestors that has been completely lost now because the Christians first took it over and then abandoned it. I mean, no Christian church goes to visit a holy well anymore, do they? Which they used to in the past. This practice still actually occurs more so in places like Ireland. They still have more reverence for their wells there as holy places.
Yeah, they have Brigid's wells all over the place. But if you go there, you see Mother Mary's everywhere. And
Yeah. They put their Christian slant on it, obviously, but like I say, archaeologically, I actually found a book, which I'm going to buy, about wells before Christianity, but I read like the preface of this book, what I could online, what I was allowed to read. It was one of those annoying ones where it gives you like 3 pages, then misses 3, then gives you another 3 pages. So it's like really hard to read. But from what I read there, this archaeologist and historian was saying that nobody's investigating what these wells were before, although we know that they are ancient. We have archaeological evidence proving that people were using these for millennia before the Christians came, but we're given no historical context to them or what they were for.
Well, people often fall into the research of the mainstream or even controlled alternatives. And I don't necessarily mean controlled as in compromised. I just mean that there's certain narratives that people go to, and they get comfortable in those narratives, whereas there's so much more that we can be delving into and be questioning. But which you've been doing a lot, and I know that there are others who have as well, but when you're on your own, you know, it's, as you know, it's a very lonely path.
Yeah, I mean, I cover a lot of areas of research at the moment because they're all related. And this is something that with my work, I'm trying to really try to put together, because modern archaeology, modern history likes linear paths. Okay. Look at etymology, for example. There we go. Here's a Proto-Indo-European word. Here it is in Proto-Germanic. Here it is in, you know, early English. Here it is in Middle English. Here it is in modern English. And it's like a linear path with no outside connection. It just follows one line. That's not how words work.
It makes it very convenient for people because then they can place things. But yeah, of course, words have multiple meanings, and what did that mean to people at the time, and all this?
Well, it's a logical path, right? It's linear. It's logical, and I'm not disputing it. By the way, people go, "Oh, so you've no." I'm saying, but there's more to that word. For instance, slightly off topic, but it's not really. I've been looking into wood because of Woden, the word wood, Woden, right? So you've got similar words. Now, Woden is known as Woden. It comes from Wodenas, Proto-Germanic, which means a frenzy, right? Frenzy, inspired, mad, even. Like Wod means mad in Old English. Now, I've written about this a bit, but so you might go, well, what's that got to do with wood? Well, an widu, the Proto-Germanic for wood, is actually related probably to an old word for maybe even wild. And we get the L there, which plays importance in Valda, well, wolds, yeah? But anyway, when it connects to widu, widu starts to mean actually like wild, like untilled ground, right? So it's the area in between the houses. I forget it now, but there's a Lithuanian word that stems from it that actually means that. Well, one of the words for Wodenas is wild, right? So you've got a connection there between wood. It's actually where we get the word widow, probably. Widow, meaning don't want to be too crude here, but you could have a look at the abandoned, but I'd more look at it like the untilled ground. Okay. I know that's a little crude, but it appears how ancestors saw that. So you have widow. It has more aspects of wild within nature, untilled, unmessed with by man, which is frenzied and crazy. But so they link, and this is actually, well, it's not mainstream, but there are etymologists that bring this forward quite prominently.
How would the word weird play in? Would that be connected?
Weird. Because that's connected to word. It's something that I need to do more investigation on, the word. But that is connected too, because we get the Y and the R type of sound with the Welsh version of widu, gwyd, or gwyd, which is from a proto-Brythonic word where they actually add a G to the beginning of the W. But the connection to Odin, you might go, well, Odin, you've got no W. Well, the proto-Indo-European word for where we get widu is udu, with a U. So we have, again, the dropping of the W for a U in this case, but it makes the U sound.
But also the idea of the weird... you were just talking about the frenzy. Well, could you just explain the concept of the weird? Well,
the weird is, in simple terms, it's our idea of fate. It's pretty much our word for fate. But it's read by the Norns that I mentioned earlier that read... weird is actually our word for Urd. People try to confuse it and say, like, the weird is read out, the cup is fate out of the well of Urd, but word in etymologically is the same as Urd in the Norse. It's an idea that the present events, and this is present events or present paths that lead somewhere, are based off previous action, which is again connected to the water because we have memory. The water's memory, that is all that has been. And all that will be is determined by the word and your weird and your actions regarding to it. So if you've got two cars on the same stretch of road on a collision course, that's the word, right? All their previous actions have led them to this point. But when they see each other, unlike fate or destiny, which is slightly fixed, we have the concept that when we see each other, we can veer off. We can change an action before the event that is predicted or the paths that will merge. We can change an action before that to veer off it. I try to think of it sometimes as a soup because it's a well. And if you add all the ingredients of the past and it's going to taste a certain way unless you add something to it, which is the self-determination or, you know, the way of the hero, you know. He can change.
Yeah, the flavors path. Could be the memories. Mm-hmm. Because yeah. If water can take on memory, can take on knowledge, then
yeah,
that would be the flavors.
But I mean, the way they explain it is through threads. That's what Cedar means. You know, when I was talking about the magic, it actually means thread.
Hmm.
And as you wind the threads, you can add new threads to this by action. And as they, and then that becomes the past. When you do a deed, it becomes the past, and that adds to the thread that the Norns weave, and which changes the future. So the word, I mean, and then you've got wood and will, and you've got, I mean, these words, all these words are connected. And I'm hoping to present this over a period of time with articles. But yeah.
You're finding the strands
mm-hmm.
Through the connections of the words, and you're being led on a journey. So it's like something's giving you yeah. these connections, and you're discovering what many people may not, because they are not following that line of thinking. They're not in the intuitive side, and that may not necessarily mean, I'm not necessarily meaning intuitive in terms of a spiritual connection, but I am as well. But I'm just saying, in terms of being open, letting your mind be open, letting yourself flow, letting yeah. your thoughts flow.
It's a good word.
Exactly. Whereas many people, I'd suggest the vast majority of people are very stuck in linear thinking, as you were saying, and mm-hmm. with certain ideas, stuck ideas that, well, I would suggest we are fed anyway. Mm-hmm. And so they can only discover within that sphere of thinking, and they can follow threads within that. At the end of the day, they'll mostly be going around in circles. Here's an interesting one. It's an mm-hmm. Indian word. So I'm just doing a little connection myself here, whether whatever you see in it. The Indian word Siddha, Siddha, which means one who is accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
Just wondering how that might connect in.
That's an Indian. Is that a Sanskrit word or just that's a modern Indian word?
I believe that is. Yeah. And yeah, you were just talking about the Siddha.
Yeah. And it is actually also connected to seed. Siddha. Yeah, the planting of an idea or something. Yeah, I mean, and what is cedar? Cedar's the threads, right? So they're planting the future seeds.
In terms of this word, I mean, I'm just mm-hmm. going off the top of my head, so I haven't gone through all the connections here, but this is partly what you are doing. And then you do find the connections, but I was just thinking that this word, which means one who has accomplished, I mean, if you have a seed and that seed sprouts, then that mm-hmm. there is something that is accomplished there. So there are connections in these various languages and words. And
etymologically, they are connected. This is what people don't understand. They go, oh, you're just making this up, right? But I'm not, because I go back to the base and I've got several dictionaries that I go through to look at these things. And I use online sources, dictionaries, et cetera, et cetera. And you find in the footnotes of some of these dictionaries, because there are many dictionaries on Proto-Germanic, Proto-this, and they're all slightly spelt differently, and it's hard to, because it's all about the sound. You'll find footnotes under the words where the person that's written this has seen the connection themselves, and they put up some examples, but they go, oh, this needs more work. So what I'm saying is not just like random, the connections are there. I mean, he was talking about the word flow, right? So flow is to move, right? But it's there's the word flower, yeah? Which means to bloom, yeah? And it's actually connected to the word feeder, especially with wolves in Old Norse. The word föða, which actually means to nurture, to give life, which later turned into Old English to fodder, for food, which then turned to food. is intimately connected to the word flower, to bloom. And you've got flow. So, I mean, that's just an interesting concept. But these words are connected etymologically. If you go off the, like I say, the linear path, if you start exploring the sounds, and like I say, these are documented by some etymologists. They just need to do more research on it. And they're trying to present a dictionary of thousands of words, right? So they haven't got time to, they've seen the connection, but they just put it as a footnote.
Well, if you follow your intuition and if your mind is connected in to this way of thinking, if you know that it exists, then you can start to put these pieces together. But if people have been made to think that this doesn't exist, when there are these connections, and part of the reason why we can intuit them is because there are these connections, which does link back to our Aryan culture, if you want to call it that.
If you go with the flow, you're a flower, right? Flower. And they are connected. They are etymologically connected.
You'll be a siddha, SIDDHA, one who has accomplished. It all links together. It's just interesting. When you flow with this, it all connects.
Yeah, I mean, it does. Yeah, the well, the woods, they all connect. I mean, what is a wood? Or any grass? I mean, because like I say, it's more wild. It's more unpacked. It's things that are growing up. It's drawing water, and drawing water is important. A well, you draw water from a well, and a well naturally draws water up if it's from a spring. And I think a lot of the early wells would have been springs, built around springs to contain spring water, as opposed to just digging down to an old water source. Although they did do that too. But springs were very important. And a spring brings things up. Yeah, it brings things up. And what do we call the season where things start to come up? We call it spring. And what is it when they're coming up? They're drawing water from the earth and bringing it upwards. So the woods or the forest is the extension of the well or the spring, because the spring brings the water to the surface, and then the trees carry up towards the heavens. Okay, so you've got a continual upward movement of water, which is important, which was very important to our ancestors, because I believe it is involved in the Thihu rune. But there's a lot, as I've learned more and more, the Thihu rune is becoming even more and more interesting. And this relates back actually to what we were talking about with the stone circles, because a lot of people, I mean, this is slightly fringe science, pseudoscience, a lot of people call it. But I mean, you've got ley lines. Now, a ley line is just simply a group of buildings in a line, normally based on ancient buildings. So churches, you know, you'll find churches, mounds. Remember, churches were built on older religious sites generally. So, and they all line up. And that's a physical thing that you can see in the landscape built by man. But some people believe that these are attached to earth energies or serpent energies or dragon energies. A female and a male generally energy form that criss and cross across the landscape. And at certain
aren't there some lines that are meant to be female and some that are meant to be male?
Well, no, the whole line, a whole ley line.
I know.
They will be crossing across the line, and where they meet, where they make connections, you'll find a monument. As they crisscross kind of straight line, they're like twisting around the line.
It's like pulsing. It's like pulsing out and coming back together, isn't it?
Yeah. It come, and sometimes they come up and down. I mean, this is something I've been looking at. A lot of the people that talk about this are very New Age. So it's trying to discern some of the things from it, but there are very real experiences some people are having. I don't agree necessarily with their interpretation of what they're saying it is or what they believe it is, etc. But
the fact that they're called ley lines, it's to explain it to people people in our modern times, because they're not actually called ley lines; they're called leys. But we call them ley lines because for the average person, they wouldn't know what you're talking about if you just said lays. So
the line helps, but because they are a line, but they're physical, they really exist, because they're just the observation of monuments in a straight line. When you get to the earth energies or serpent energy or dragon energies, it becomes very speculative. There is some evidence, some certain things that are measuring certain energies that seem to have some backing, but a lot of it's done with dowsing, which is obviously a science that's not accepted mainstream. But this all connects to the water, because this is this drawing up of an energy, because water is life. I mean, we're made of water. Now, this is why Cedar, a male that practiced Cedar in war, was very dangerous. Woden could practice bind magic, right? Now, bind, you've got Cedar, because it's a thread, so it binds you, yeah? But also, you've got, there's many examples in early literature that people are being frozen in battle. That's what binding means. It means that you can't move, you can't run, and you can't fight. And people might go, but this is just explaining a natural freezing, you know, like the rabbit staring into the headlights. But in the accounts that were given through the historic writing, or the old historic writing, they're saying that this was actually seasoned warriors. We're talking about people that had fought many battles and won. They weren't the type. It's not like a new warrior that's just froze in the middle of battle.
Well, it's interesting you talk about that, because there are many Chinese kung fu series, and in these programs, they accept the idea that we have these powers. And there's one power that people have where they press certain points on somebody's body, and then they're frozen. So it's interesting that in the East, many of these ideas survive, which most likely actually come from us. Yet in the West, perhaps due to Christianity, and probably mostly Christianity, we've been made to forget this, and perhaps we had a very high culture where we knew a lot of this. Also, linking in with the lines, with the energy lines, I mean, then there's the Kundalini, the idea of the Kundalini, and there's the spine of Albion. Would you like to speak of that?
Yeah, I mean, they have Feng Shui, or Feng Shui, however you pronounce it. It's all about dragon lines. Okay, so in the East, just as an example of what I'm talking about in the West, but yeah, the spine of Albion is a ley line that runs directly center of Britain as a whole, including the islands. I mean, it is directly center, and it is the easiest route north to south on mainland Britain, meaning that there's only one water crossing, which has to happen from a north-south straight line from Britain, by the way, because of the way the geography. And the one water crossing is at the shortest point in that waterway. And Birmingham is on, there's loads of cities on it, major cities. And it goes straight up. And now that's a ley line that you can physically see. There are buildings and old ancient monuments that you can track the line. It exists. If you just put in the spine of Albion, you'll see a map, and it'll show you all the significant places on it. And the significant places are where the connections are. There is a lot of, you know, people can attack ley lines a little bit, but there are 33 points on there, if you include Scotland. There's 22 in England and 11 in Scotland, major points, which add to 33, which is that's where it gets its name, the spine, because there are 33 vertebrae in the human spine. So, and it's right up the centre as well. I mean, obviously, it's the spine, it's up the centre, but also it has 33 connection nodes. And connection nodes, like I said before, where they say these people that do dowsing, I've never done dowsing, I haven't physically experienced this, it's just something I'm reading into at the moment a little bit. I'm no expert on this stuff, but it's where they connect. So you have a male energy and a female energy connecting, and there are 33 of these, they call them nodes, I believe, these node points on the spine of Albion. Obviously, then it gets us into the esoteric 33, but this gets us into a whole subject of how a lot of our symbols are used against us.
You are listening to Renegade Broadcasting. Back in 3 minutes. To this edition of Never So Defined and Proud on Renegade Broadcasting with your host Chris, with guest Ethan Vegan.
A lot of our symbols are used against us. The easiest analogy for this is the gun, right? The gun is a tool. If it's in the hands of your savior or your hero or a soldier that's protecting you, it's a very positive thing. If it ends in the hands of an enemy, it's a very negative thing. And I believe this is how they use our symbols, and how if these energy lines are true. And I've heard about these energy lines before, just to give some clarification on where I stand with them. But I'd kind of put them off as a little bit weird. It wasn't until I started doing research into the words. And as you mentioned before, what I do with words is I kind of let the words speak to me. I don't put any meaning on them. I allow them to tell me their story, just by looking at them and looking how they were used. But as I've worked with these words, I've started to see this, especially through the Fihu poem, working a lot with that, I've started to see this connection to a serpent energy. And I mean, I've told you privately, but I will say here that I watch talks before I go to bed generally, because I don't have time to do it in the day. And when I've got time to physically do things, I sit at my computer and do research. So, but on a night, I get a chance to just watch something that's based on what I'm doing, but I can just watch it as I'm in bed. And I generally fall asleep sometimes before the end. But what I used to do was whenever I was dealing with a goddess or a god, I would just say, what should I watch? Help me find something. And on numerous occasions, actually nearly every time, say I'm dealing with Brigid. I was doing one night, as an example, I was doing research on Woden and the words that relate to Woden, especially related to the tree of Yggdrasil and Woden. And I was also, I was also doing a little bit of research on Brigid. But I just decided to ask Brigid to just show me. I mean, it's a silly thing that maybe, you know, we all have little quirks. So I said, you know, show, and I picked a video that had nothing in the title about it. It was about ley lines. And in the first 10 minutes, they mentioned the goddess Brigid or Brigantia. And about just over halfway through, they mention Woden and an ancient ash tree in the middle of England, which I just thought was interesting. But that happens a lot. But that's maybe what you were saying earlier about the intuition more. And how, you know, we follow a flow, right? We go with a flow and the flow allows us, you know, I'm not necessarily saying that God showed it me, but I'm saying that I was in a flow of that information and I attracted it to me because I was open to it. And yeah, do you want to say something there? Sorry.
Yeah, well, obviously these points that we had at our sacred sites have then been taken over by perhaps a church, or even maybe these places have been used by dark forces. They've been either draining the energy or putting negative energy into the grid, perhaps.
Yeah, now, what I'll say about, like I say, I still need to do more research into this, but as a speculative researcher, as far as I've got now, I was watching some talks about these guys. I mean, they were slightly hippie-ish, and they were going along trying to repair these lines, right? Giving them intent and intention, like I said before, because that's important. So the energy knew what it was doing, etc. On the more hippie side, shall I say, for want of a better word, on the New Age side, they believe that the lines want to help you, although I think, like many of their ideas, they're slightly loose, cut and loose with it, as in they'll just help you do anything. But anyway, these guys were going up and trying to repair the lines, essentially. And I was watching it and I was like, what the hell is this? It was another one of those times when I was drawn to something and I was thinking it was a little bit out there. But then they started talking, unbeknownst to them, they were talking about certain place, but it was very dark energy. And I was like, okay, this is interesting. Where is it? And it was I forget the name of them now, but a very powerful family in England. And that they owned the land, this light, that this node point connected. And they were saying it was very dark around there. Almost, his exact words, I believe, were almost as if it had been, the energy had been sucked dry by something. And just to give an example of what they were saying is, before I go into that anymore, when they were doing repair on these lines, they were just like trying to, and what they found was that when they'd return a few years later, something like a big open to the public herb garden was built on a node, and things were being built, very positive things for the community after they'd done their healing. So they were saying that this was evidence that it was working, which, you know, they had some interesting evidence there for sure. But on this node, particularly, like I say, it was very dark, and it was, they couldn't get in. But some people did break in, actually, climbed the walls and started doing things in there. It was an old church, I believe, but it was like dilapidated. But it was on the grounds of this rich family. And over several years of them doing this, suddenly the area got planning permission to be refurbished, etc., and it got new life into it. But obviously, from my perspective, now I know, and being a bit more into the esoteric sometimes, you have got this connection. Were this very powerful, ancient, powerful family, I think from Norman times, had they been using this this node point for malicious intent, this energy force? Like I say, there's still a lot to do there. Research wise, it's more of a fringe research I'm doing at the moment. This is something I more do at night, when I'm in bed, just to get myself a base knowledge in this stuff. But yeah, I found that very interesting, how they could be using this energy to keep themselves wealthy, keep themselves powerful. it seems to me that they use a lot of that. I mean, something that occurred to me when I was doing boar research recently, I talk about the boar a bit, but it's a fascinating symbol. In fact, it is related to, it is an exceptionally important symbol, but I won't bore everybody with any more of it for the pun. But with my boar research, I realized that, you know, to put it in very simple terms, the boar is about facing the struggle, the life. It comes from the mother goddess because it is born of the mother goddess. And you can either, it's the challenges of life, the struggle of life. But you can become the boar in certain aspects to your enemies, for example, because you're their challenge. Okay. And you can, and it does relate to spiritual authority. But in this case, in this element of it, which does link to the others, but in this element, it's about sacrifice, being able to sacrifice for the greater, for yourself and for your folk. I believe it does relate to Woden. One of the interpretations of Woden sacrifices himself to himself. He sacrifices, because this probably needs a bit of explanation before I go into it. To sacrifice to himself, with himself. Okay, so we've got very, if you look at us from very primitive or very simple analogy, right, we experience pleasure and we experience pain. Generally, we will move away from pain and move towards pleasure. The noble warrior or the noble hero who challenges the boar faces the pain of life. He endures pain of life. I recently did an article on Starkadder, who endured hardship when he didn't need to keep himself strong, to keep himself ready. So he was facing the boar at every turn. He was finding the boar, seeking the boar of the mother goddess to prove his worth and to overcome. So this is an element of sacrifice, sacrificing the pleasures for the pains to become greater. Sorry for that long preface.
That's also where you live. It's kind of this window in between pleasure and pain, but you expand that window so that the pain does not affect you as much, but also the pleasures also does not, you don't get stuck in the pleasure either. It's, you have a greater window of your own experience of life and this world, whereas many people, they've been cut down to a very small window of experience where the good and the bad are very poignant to them. It's actually very primitive, yet we're made to believe that we're very advanced, but we've been so comforted and mollycoddled that people react emotionally to events and ideas around them.
Yeah,
where
I mean,
instead of intuitively experiencing beyond the idea of the positive and the negative.
Yeah, well, the Thorn rune comes very early after the Fihu rune. It's the third one. I haven't done extensive research on that yet, but given its basic meaning at the moment, you know, endurance, it's, if you live a life of complete comfort, right? Where everything's done for you, you're not going to grow spiritually, physically. You know, people lift weights. It's a resistance, right? It's heavy and it's hard, but they do it to overcome. So they endure the pain of lifting the weights when they could be sitting down, eating crap, watching TV, right? They don't have to do that, but they do it. They do it to get stronger in a physical sense. And this also applies to every aspect of your life. If you want to harden yourself to cold, you go out in the cold. Okay, you want to harden yourself and become stronger and more well-rounded in anything, you have to endure a certain amount of pain. That's facing the boar. That's facing the boar of life, and through that you will grow. Yeah, you can't grow through just comfort.
Yeah, it's beyond simply convenience. I see so many people nowadays that they take the convenient path in terms of their understanding of the world or an idea, or they'll live in a way that's, what's the word, efficient for them, where they don't need to know much more than they do. They don't need to think outside of a certain way of approaching the world, and so they have a stuck set of understanding. And
yeah, because they're on a logical, it's a logical path, right? It's the utilitarian, right? You only do what you need to do. You don't do anything beyond that. That's the logical. That's just looking at the atom in itself. It's not looking at the whole. The spiritual person, or the one that wants to get stronger in any way, whether it be physically, spiritual, or anything, like I said, has to endure. Okay, endurance. He has to sacrifice himself to himself. He has to sacrifice the pleasures of life for the hardships of life to become better. And that's what I believe one aspect of that sacrificial story of Woden is about. It's about sacrificing some of the pleasures for some of the hardships to grow. Because anybody that's read about Woden, or as many people call him, Odin, he's constantly trying to gain wisdom, gain knowledge, gain. And I believe that is to save us, actually. I believe not save us as in like a Jesus figure, but it's because he wants to stop a Ragnarok, not have it happen. So he's constantly on challenging and facing. That's why he sacrifices an eye. That's why he hangs, he's always sacrificing to gain something.
But ironically, when the hero rises, then the battle comes to face them anyway. But I suppose when that happens, they are preventing something larger from happening further downstream, and then the hero obviously gets blamed for causing.
Is something that's linked with Woden too. Whenever Woden appears, there's wars, but that's not because Woden wants the war. It's because He's appearing in the hero as he presents himself. When these energies come to life, when the gods or people are getting in tune, like the National Socialists did, they're going to be tried to be stamped out, because they're not going to allow this to come forward, or any idea of the concepts of this, because it's too inspiring. Because Woden is a inspirational leader. But before I get onto that, I'd just like to jump back, so we haven't lost the listeners completely, on where I was going with this dark energy, or these people sucking this energy dry, and to put how, we hear a lot about sacrifice, paedophilia, that it's rife within our leadership, and sacrificing children, whatever, all this disgusting revolt.
Well, that's sacrificing others rather than sacrificing yourself.
They're warped. What they're doing is they can't do it, so they're doing it to somebody else who is pure. When you realize what they're doing everything the noble person is doing, but in the opposite, the reverse.
Well, it's interesting that the word goy is yog backwards.
Mm-hmm.
They're turning us around and making them the so-called nobles when they are anything but noble.
They're having the element of sacrifice there, but they're not doing it to themselves. They're doing it to somebody else. That's why we have the horned god, right? Now, interesting, in some of my research, I did a little article on Nerthus. Now, Nerthus comes, the word, the actual etymology of that word, I believe, is Proto-Brythonic. And it means, and it is Proto-Indo-European. You can take it right back, but it's a masculine energy. And I explained it in the article as maybe the birthing of the woman possessing the seed of the man. So she has both the masculine energy and the female energy in one. The pregnant lady, the mother goddess, essentially. But it's interesting because I was rethinking about my old research on Kunnunos, because that's where all this started, really, with Kunnunos. It was the horned god that led me to the boar, that led me to other things. And I have a lot of praise for Kunnunos, or the horned god. Now, Kunnunos, if we separate that word, I haven't done an article on this yet or anything, but Kunnunos, you've got Kern, which means horn. It's where you get cairn from, with the stones, relating back to the stones, etc. So it means literally horn. Now, nunos, they say is just, you know, it's a Latin, because in Latin they have these, you know, these end tail off things that don't really mean anything. But if you actually look at it, it's a nunos. If you look at nunos in old Latin, it's where we get the word nun, for instance. But it's highly related to the female. Nun is a nun, but because it would have to be nonos to be masculine, but it's nunos. So we have nun, but it kind of means ancestor, wise ancestor or wise old person or wise spiritual person. So in that, but it's got a female edge to it with the nunos spelling and pronunciation. So in Canunos, you have a female aspect in this horned god. And with Nerfus, you have this masculine aspect, which is hermetic. Both the masculine and female energies combining. Right at these node points, we have the same examples where they combine. Now, what is their god? What is the god given to these evil overlords of ours at the moment? Baphomet.
Horned god.
Horned, with breasts, female and masculine. They've created an abomination, an opposite to our gods and goddesses. Mm. I don't believe they're the same, and this is where there's confusion. People then go, well, paganism is just this. No, what they've done is they've took the they've followed the most negative route of the spiritual path. And in doing so, I believe they've probably, you know, this is slightly speculative, but, you know, I believe in the gods and goddesses totally. I don't just accept them as, you know, an intellectual thought. I believe that there are these sacred powers. And I believe that there could be negative ones that are in the image, similar image to that of the positive ones, but they just do everything negatively, okay?
Well, they completely twist the mean with the Baphomet. It actually has breasts, and it actually, I mean, it even has aspects of other creatures to it. I mean, the horned god, all like that I see for myself is a man with horns. I don't know if there are other aspects to it. And then of course Odin, he doesn't literally have breasts or that. I mean, he has those aspects in his consciousness, surely. I mean, am I correct in my assertions?
Well, he practiced Sita, it's a female magic.
But with the Baphomet, it's like it's an abomination in itself.
Yeah,
self.
Just like the sacrifice. When I was talking about the sacrifice, they're not sacrificing their own pleasures or themselves for the greater good. They're sacrificing others. They're like, it's like a negative image. And it's not reversed. Like people think it's the same path. It's just that there's the high path that's dealing with the gods and goddesses, the good ones. It's taking you to something better, self-sacrifice, about betterment, sacrifice for your tribe. Like if you go to war and you die, you're fighting for your folk. It's your sacrifices for the betterment of the wider folk. What their sacrifice is the logical, the atomized.
The lower the form of sacrifice, which is sacrificing. And that's why the...
Somebody else, yeah.
Yeah. That's why the symbol is a literal depiction of the female and male together in with all sorts, whereas our versions are the higher form, which is Odin has his male consciousness, but then he also takes in the female aspect as well.
There is hermetic aspect.
Yeah, but I'm sure that there are also female versions that then take on the male aspect as well.
Brigid has a spear, Brigantia. She has very masculine aspects to her. It goes through, and this is not like another abomination of this. Is this transgenderism at the moment? See, it's almost mocking of our gods, whilst elevating theirs. Like in Kernunos with the female aspects. I mean, in the picture on the Gundestrup cauldron, which I actually have as my picture here, so you can see it. But he's holding a snake, right? And he's holding a guttorc. Now, I believe that the snake energy is related to a masculine energy, maybe, and the torque is related to the boar, which is actually the goddess. And if you look at those when he's holding them, if anybody looks at the Gundestrup cauldron, Kernunos, so just type in Kernunos, it's normally the image you'll get up first. He's holding a snake in one hand, which is a long phallic symbol, essentially. And he's holding what looks like a circle with an opening, a female symbol, right? and the torque, sorry for people that don't understand, without explaining, torque, the one that you wear around your neck, the Gauls wore, were famous for, it comes from the word torcus, Proto-Celtic, and which where we get the word pork, because torcus means boar, but it also means it's another, it's an epithet of like a warrior or hero or chief. Okay, so it's related to the boar through torque, although they say it's about twisting, but it is also about twisting, but because it's twisted. But I mean, this is where we get these connections that are, because the boar, if you look at that picture, you'll see its feminine aspect in that diagram, in that depiction of Canonus. But
so would I be correct in thinking that the past represents the female and the present represents the future? Because
the past and the past and the future are pretty much the domain of the feminine. It's the present.
So
it's the present. I would say, I mean, I'm being speculative here again. I need to do more research, but the masculine is the present. And the reason for that is because the masculine's duty is to protect this sacred line. I haven't said this on air before, sorry. So,
well,
if you've got a woman holding a baby, so not breastfeeding a child, if you follow that image has reoccurred for the past, for return to the beginning, and as long as that bloodline continues, we go into the future. The baby comes, the female baby comes out of the woman. And so does the male baby, but out of the womb, yeah, comes out of the womb. And then through her womb comes another female. And then this female line continues forever. The waters, yeah, definitely. And the water that's also his blood, but we can go back to that. The masculine's duty is not just to provide the seed, that vital energy to create that life that comes in the woman, but the masculine duty is to protect this sacred line that has gone on, that has gone on since the beginning of time. So he's very much in the present, whereas the woman is carrying the past and the future.
Well, this is why I was suggesting that the male perhaps represents the future, but perhaps the male creates the future through the now. And if we're talking about, I mean, the now, there isn't really a future, really, but there's the now, really. The future is a future past. So it's a very abstract idea, I guess.
I've mentioned this in an article, how we have no future tense in Germanic languages. We have past tense and present tense because the future is not yet determined. The future,
exactly. Well, if the present is weaving the future from past, then there is no defined future, is there? There's just the path that leads forwards in time.
Yeah, and that's why the masculine aspect is about a protective aspect and creating the environment that the line can carry. That's why the female is, from the earliest times, from the Venus figurines, etc., is the original goddess, because she's the nourisher, the fooder, the fodder, the feeder, the flowerer, the flower. Yeah, she brings life in and carries it on to the future. The masculine energies were always depicted more warlike or protective, because they have to be, because physically we're endowed with more strength, and that is our main duty. And now I've covered this topic before about female warriors. They did exist, obviously, and they can be ferocious. I mean, there is nothing more powerful than a woman protecting a child. I don't think there is any limit to that motherly bond in what that woman would do, and what a mother would do to protect a child. I don't know if there would be even a limit on that. The masculine should have that power as well, but in the modern day, obviously, we see that less. And look at our society, it's completely overrun. Because, people blame women a lot in this movement, but men were in charge of the gate. In our recent past, men had a lot of power, and they've let us down. I mean, not all men. We're slaves, and that's the man's duty to enslave us or not be slaved in the first place. And I don't want to take away from the female aspect there, but what I'm saying is these people that just blame the women, saying, of course, women are more open to, you know, nurturing aspects of their psyche. Well, of course they are, because they've got to bring up children. It takes a lot of patience. I know this from trying to bring up mine. It takes a lot of patience. It takes a lot of effort and a lot of nurturing and loving and things that are not associated with necessarily warfare, unless they're in danger, of course. But to blame the women is kind of counterproductive, because it's saying that the masculine then has no power, although these people that promote this believe that the masculine should have power. And in our recent history, especially through Christianity, the masculine was elevated a lot.
But it was twisted, of course.
Of course, it was twisted. I don't know. This is where I want to put things straight. Just as I go, you know, all these women that are brainwashed into accepting immigrants or whatever, I don't blame them for their brainwashing.
Well, that's twisted now. Just as the masculine was twisted before.
Yeah, and I don't actually attack what's in control, the man or the idea, right?
It's these dogmatic ideas that people are being fed because they've been disconnected from their intuition, their dynamic thinking, so that they can't see the bigger picture. So they're just defending their own angle, their own side, and they're seeing all of these other ideas that they see as afflicting them, when they're not looking beyond, you know, this maze, stepping back and seeing the game.
The Fihu poem, you know, the wolf grows up in the forest, or the wolf lives in the forest. The wolf is nurtured by the forest. The forest that we live in at the moment is what's feeding us, what's making us flower, is poison. And this is both for the male and the female. Our forest is a forest of poison that our young people are growing up in.
It's death-based life, because we're living off technology and lies. And
So if this is the environment, so I don't blame the person. I attack the ideas. I don't hate the communist. I hate the people that are spreading the ideas that originated the ideas. I don't necessarily blame the individual that's brainwashed if they've grown up in an environment that's fed them that. And look at our universities. If the young person's forest is a university, I mean, it's almost a miracle that any come out without these poisoned ideas. They're flowering through poison, but they can equally bloom through proper nurturing and healthy environments, healthy forests. And I think this is very important, that we don't just attack people. We attack ideas, the very concept.
Well, of course, they also program the feminists into the negative aspect of the male as well. So it's like they also have that power, but it's not stepping into their own power, and it's not also empowering the males either, because of course many of them don't want the males to be empowered. They don't think that there is any reason for that, but we all need to be empowered to be ourselves in both our male and female aspects, but the true male and female aspects, which is beyond the whole of these narratives that we're being given, because we're only being given their versions of it, which of course are the lies to entrap us. They're the lower forms, which is exactly what we're talking about.
They're their lowest form. They're gods.
And I think that when we do step into our higher forms, then we do also take on board, if we're open enough, the opposite aspect as well, because we can see the importance of that.
If we face our own challenges, that's how you grow spiritually. You face your own challenges, which it could be anything. You know, if you've got a messy house, clean it. Whatever you endure till it becomes normal, till endurance becomes normal, then you're undefeatable. Who can beat a man that seeks hardship, seeks the struggle to go better? Because by the end of it, he's stronger than anybody, stronger willed, stronger physically, stronger mentally, stronger spiritually, because he is overcome. He's a survivor. That is what the Mother Goddess is teaching us by sending the ball. The ball's not, people just see it as a struggle. They don't even realize it. In that aspect, a lot of people, they just see it as a token of war. But we must be durable. We must be able to endure. But when we take on our natural roles, and I don't just mean woman with, you know, a woman is fierce instigator. There's nothing that can motivate a man more than a woman's scorn. Okay, but that's whether you're trying to attract a woman. Heroes attract women because they prove themselves by facing the struggle. Whether it's because the man's, you know, at home in the modern age, women nag, right? They go, women nag. Well, that's part that in their truest form, that's inspirational. In the modern feminist idea of it, it's nagging. But in its truest form, it inspires the man to go out and be better. To protect her line, because her duty is to the sacred line, the line that goes all the way back to all the way forward. That's her duty. And she has to kick men up the ass sometimes because men can procrastinate. That's one of our, whereas they might nag, but procrastination is the man's thoughtfulness to make sure he gets it right. There's a balance there. And the females can be, like I say, ferocious. And the males can be nurturing too, just to give an aspect. It's not cut and dry. But each of us, you know, like I suppose the yin yang symbol, right? You know, as an example, because it's kind of simplistic, you know, in the black, there's a little bit of white, and in the white, there's a little bit of black. And I don't mean that in a miscegenation ways, but what it's saying is that in the feminine, there's a bit of the male, in the male, there's a bit of female. So we can both have certain aspects of each other, and it comes out in certain times. Like when I'm looking after my children, I need to embrace that more nurturing aspect of myself.
It's a very profound idea, really, but it's a living idea, whereas people then take that as a static idea, a very dogmatic idea of the black and the white, and they're intertwined, and you know, that's it. Because it does get taken on by your Buddhist types, your New Age types,
New Age,
and yeah, they simplify everything down rather than make it, because I mean it's a very living symbol. It's deliberately
as well.
Deliberately
mess it up. I started watching some of this stuff, and because some of it is more, and I'll give a good example of this. Some of it is more, like I say, out there, New Age, right? But I came across something recently, and it linked me. When this guy was talking, I had to turn him off because he said, well, the woman gets in charge of whether she has a child or not. And I was like, okay, so he's linking this to modern, like, abortion debates, right? Well, it was interesting that when I was, as you know, I've got some Irish friends, and they link things, or because of what they like, I see it on my Twitter, right? There was this thread, and they were Christians, Catholics, obviously, we're talking about Ireland, but they were, I mean, and they were attacking paganism, but they had a right to attack this form of paganism because I didn't, you know, it's nothing that I would go to. Because apparently the minister for children in Ireland, and I forget her name now, I wasn't thinking I was going to talk about this, but she's a Wiccan, or a very New Age Wiccan. And she's wrote a book about this, but and linked to other books, and in some of these other books that are linked to her book, they talk about the female as in, like, abortion is a sacrifice to the mother goddess. Now, this is an absolute abomination. I was saying the mother goddess is facing the struggle of life, not abandoning that struggle for selfish purposes. And this is again the lower aspect. They're sacrificing the child, not themselves, for the child. They're worshipping this abomination of a god. Which
how could somebody in that position say such a thing?
Well, she hasn't said that directly. She wrote a book that kind of linked. I haven't read the book. I have bookmarked it to read. But this Wiccan group that she's in, this type of Wiccanism, it's like feminist Wiccans. It's something that's coming out of them. It's something that I've got on like a very long list of something to look into. But, yeah, that... there was some talk about people doing it deliberately to get pregnant, to have an abortion, to make the sacrifice to the mother goddess, which is not the mother goddess. It's an abomination. Whatever they're sacrificing to, they don't understand her at all. And they're doing it for selfish reasons, which is the complete opposite of any a true sacrifice to the mother goddess. But yeah. I mean, but just that's just an example of some of the things that come out in this, as you said, this the lowest form of something, how it's an opposite, but it's not opposite. It's the same things. It's about sacrifice and it's about this, but they've warped it to the point where they don't have to, they gain and lose nothing, which actually makes them weak, though, just to be understood. They're weak.
They've sold themselves out to it. I don't know if there's any way back for them after they've sold out. I mean, they have to, they're invested in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they've sold themselves to a selfish power. I don't know how it's going to treat them. I worship the mother goddess. I worship Woden. I worship Kanunos. I worship the self-sacrificers, the givers of life, not the destroyers. So I don't know what they hope to gain from this, but this is part of the poison that we grow up in. It's something that I particularly hate, because in this thread you could see that these Catholics were, and rightly so, they were disgusted by what they saw. But then they attach it to somebody like me, right? They attach it. I saw this disgusting Wiccan male, fucking some whatever he was, who'd just been done for molesting a 15-year-old girl because he was telling her that in a previous life they were together or something. Wiccans defended him and he got off. These vile pieces of crap that in the name of paganism or in the name of heathenism, which I get attached to because I'm part of it, but I'm not part of what they are, but they sully my name and they sully the name of my gods and goddesses. These are complete shit to me. I mean, and this is the same for these leaders, or like you say, so-called leaders, these so-called elite. They're not elite to me. They worship death. There was a recent, well, it was from a 2015 article about, I mean, I'm going off the topic a little bit here, well, I'm not, but about Corbyn, how he'd covered up a sex scandal in Islington. We know about Islington. Anybody that lives in the UK, it's like it's where a lot of these paedophile groups, because there's poor right next to wealthy. I mean, you've got like seriously wealthy right next to dirt poor. So you've got a perfect opportunity for exploitation. And how in childcare homes there were certain people that came forward and going, no, we're getting a lot of abused children and being abused in care. And when Corbyn was the MP for that area, they approached him with it and he never covered it and covered it up. One of the women that was head of the child groups there for child care, she actually became on to be a very prominent Labour politician. Just showing you that these disgusting people. And when I was reading about this, I mean, obviously for people like us, all the dots connect. It's just about these people are sick. But then I realised it really occurred to me, it really struck me that these people are no authority on me. None. If the police, if whoever wants to knock at my door and try to charge me, these have nothing. They are lower than low. They're nothing on me. They can't hurt me. They can't attack me. Okay? Because they worship death. They worship. Their actions alone are so disgusting, so despicable, that how could I even fear that? How could I even fear something that is so lowly, so desperate, so degenerate, so comforted, so weak? I don't have to fear that. And I think this is something we need to understand. These have no authority over us. Give them none. Fear none of their authority at all. And I mean, really don't fear it, because when you fear it, that's a chink in your armor. And that come after the fear, because that's what they sniff out. They sniff out the negative. Be strong, be positive, and know that you do not fear them. They can't harm you. I tell you, they can't. It's only when you give in to the fear and you worry about what they're going to do. You worry if you say this or if you do that, they're going to do whatever. Don't worry. We need to embrace that we are better than them in every way. We are their superior.
Well, eventually you need to step forward anyway, and you shouldn't compromise your mission, your life mission. You need to flow in your own path. And you are supported in that because you are in your natural flow, whereas if you have to constantly make your own steps forward, if you have to constantly be judging every step you take, or it's you're not following your own path, you're following what you think that you should do or what's convenient.
I mean, we can look at this in the aspect of the martyr. If we're facing the bourn, we're willing to struggle and sacrifice certain aspects of our life and make those sacrifices for our folk, for our people. What do they do by harming us? This is the concept of the martyr. It's not just a physical thing. It's not just where people go by it. Concept of the martyr, then you empower the force that they fight for because you have made the ultimate sacrifice for that force.
Yeah.
You only empower their enemy. Their enemy is us, the good. They only empower the good. I mean, this is one of the reasons, I mean, going again off into a bit of a weird area here, but one of the reasons they had to destroy the Germans after World War II, because look at all those men that willingly sacrificed themselves for their folk. This was not a sacrifice of fear. This was not a sacrifice like they do by harming children. This was a sacrifice of love. Now, they didn't want to die. It's not like they went out there to die, but they were willing to, and many did, for their folk. Now, although I wish that had never happened, what I'm saying is that there is a... That sacrifice, that their willingness to put their lives at that on the edge and in many cases lose them, that was the ultimate of facing the ball, right? That is the ultimate of facing the challenges of life. That is the ultimate that they could give. They could give nothing more. That empowered the good. That's why they had to, that empowered the Germanic psyche. That empowered the Germanic people. So once they did that, what did they do? They had to go all wholesale, destroy them, because that sacrifice has power. All those souls that willingly did it for the love of their people, willingly went to war, that has a massive charge in it. That has a massive power in it that they fear.
It was a spark they had to put out, yeah.
They had to kill everything that it was for, because if what it was for lived, it would eventually, that power would eventually rise back up in the people. But that energy, that loving sacrifice, that willingness to fight for the folk would come back into the people. It would recharge, re-energize. So they had to destroy as many of them as they could. And not only destroy them physically by killing them, but mentally. They had to destroy them with all manner of perversion.
They had to do the denazification after the war as well, to basically to put out the flames, the little flames that were still alive in people, to get rid of any
the German people that are still there, that energy is still there for them to get. It's still there. Those millions of people that went, that died not necessarily many of them died when they were being tortured or harmed, but those that willingly died, that was a positive force for the good.
Yeah.
And that energy is still there. It's in those battlefields.
I agree with that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's in those battlefields where they died. And that energy is for them. Those sacrifices were for them. So they can use that energy. They can use it to fight for their folk right now. It's there and attainable to them. And I don't know all the answers how to get there. I don't claim to be anything. I'm just seeking. I'm a seeker. I seek what I want. I seek the knowledge that's there. And I don't know. Maybe you have to do it in your own way anyway. And
do you think this is connected to the idea of karma? Laying the seeds and then not necessarily you yourself, but maybe the folk can gain from what's been laid, the foundations.
Yeah. I believe that there probably is more of a... I do believe in the racial soul, very much so. And if the karma is related to anything, it could be related to that. But yet again with them, then there's something warped in it. Again with karma, it's somehow by our consent, they make us consent. I think that's one of the reasons they tell us what's happening, right? It's there to see. And because we don't see it or don't act upon it, we're consenting. And by consenting, they pass that karma on to us. Yeah.
They're twisting the rules so that perhaps there are rules to this realm and they know them, so that they're using our ignorance so that we end up...
Similar with the goddess god things, isn't it? How they're doing the sacrifice, but in the warped way. It's like they're abusing some form of it that would be an abomination to anybody else. And they've created like a warped path of everything. I mean, like I say, I'm no expert on all of this.
Well, they may be supported by other deities to what we are. They are attached to something else, whereas we are attached to a different force, and perhaps we are led, we are supported by what we are connected to, and perhaps we can even change allegiances for the worse. Not that obviously we shouldn't be doing that, but I'm not sure if it can go the other way with the, you know, somebody going from something dark to something light.
The good's got to be good, right? And this is an aspect of people go, we need to fight like they fight. No, we don't. We're about self-sacrifice. We're about that's how the good works. The good cannot use the tactics of evil, because then it becomes evil by its very definition.
Well, what they want to do is so that people are so compromised that when they realize what they've actually done, then they go along with it. Whereas most people are ignorant. Yeah.
I mean, look at people. Most people, and this is really a psychological problem that most people in the West have, especially the Western world, especially white people, because of our conscience, because we're good, right? We are good. You must understand that. Because of our conscience, when we get aware of things, we look back at our past and we go, well, I wasn't always perfect. Because, like I said, we were born into a poisoned forest. The poison forest fed us, and we did things that we wouldn't dream of doing today. But then we let that beat us, so we put our heads down. Rather than, we have to let some things go sometimes of the past, especially when they were innocent mistakes. People, you know, I've done things of the past, you know, like I did drugs, I did this, I did that, went out drinking all the time. I'm not proud of that. I don't say it with any pride. But it wasn't my nature to be like that. It was the nature that was around me, and it was mostly drug addicts and drunks. Generally, are decent people. Shut off from the world because they cannot cope with. They see it for its absolute evil and back away.
It's instead off. Of when they see it, instead of embracing it and compromising to it. They have no other way of dealing with it that they know of. They have to shut off. And then, of course, you have these new age people saying, oh, just go into the light or whatever. I mean, you know, it's not easy when you're living with this shit, especially if people are living when people are really cut down, you know.
Any new agers listening to this really need to understand that what they're worshipping is the negative. All these people, the love and light, that proclaim that they're not. They're worshipping death and darkness. And I'll tell you why. Because they're all based on selfless incarnation. So they say that, you know, they do this creative thing, right? You can bring everything to you and create. But they ignore that everybody else is creating too. So if somebody gets hit by a car, they go, oh, you created that. I mean, they do go to these levels. I've mixed with these people. They do literally go to these levels, like you brought it on yourself. Now, why that might be a factor, a point, maybe you should look better, but also they're ignoring the intention of the driver. And also, I used to pose this question to them, what about the baby that got abused or murdered or whatever? How did that intend it? They do it on their aspects, and most of them, you will find this if you look at these new age idiots, most of them are upper middle class, very wealthy, and have nothing to fucking worry about. And they go around telling everybody else that they've talked to Pleiadians or something. And we should all freaking just chill out and embrace stuff because, you know, we don't want to offend. And they don't want to offend anybody. They're an affront to life. And any of them listening now, I'm like, oh, no, but I just want everyone to be happy. With the truth of the world is it's not just like that. You know, if the gazelle doesn't run, if the gazelle doesn't follow its natural instinct to run when the lion comes, its life is absorbed by the lion. Okay, and sometimes there's evil out there. That there's people out there, whether you believe in evil or not, it doesn't matter. There's people out there are responsible for despicable acts, and you've got to turn that love into a realized love. And when a real realized love, and see that harm as a harm on you or a harm on your loved ones. And when you do, you realize that love is not all nicey play games. Love is what I was talking about earlier with the mother protecting her child, is the most vengeful force on the planet. When you strike, if somebody walked up to my child and struck my child, I'd rip their face off. Yeah. If I had a weapon at hand, I'd probably freaking kill them. Yeah. Because that's not because I hate them. I don't know who they are. I haven't had time to hate them. But I've had enough time to love my child enough to not let that happen and to punish and be vengeful on the person that did it. Vengeance is the aspect of love, not hate. I mean, this is a really people hate takes time to fester. Love is instant vengeance.
A lot of the New Age people will then defend the abuser by saying, yeah, as you were saying, oh, but they, yeah, had a past life together. They convolute, yeah, everything.
Kind of crap. Yeah. Like some kind of crap. Like, well, in a past life, he did it to him, right? So it's, yeah, all fair, right? It's just some kind of karmic balance that we can't understand.
Well, everything has to be nice. Everything has to be, everybody has to be innocent at some point. It's like, oh, it's just the way it is because there's some imbalance in the universe and everything's trying to right itself.
Now they're just despise. I despise them. The ideas that they go to are allowing or tolerating this world. Tolerance is not something we need right now. I tell you that now. We've got paedophiles running our governments. We've got sick shit happening. We've got bombs going off in the Middle East. Now, you know, I don't want Middle Easterners in my country, but I don't want to be bombing their freaking children. You know, what kind of sado, you know, what kind of element is this? And this is part of their reason for getting involved in the white nationalist movement. So we don't give a fuck about people. We don't give a fuck about life when we should be protecting life at all costs. And all our life first, because that's how nature intended it. You protect your own first. But we shouldn't be agreeing to willingly bomb other life for no valid reason. Okay. So tolerance is the last thing we need right now. We don't need tolerance in this society. We need intolerance. We need to stop tolerating this shit. We need to stop tolerating the daily abuses, even the minor ones, the microaggressions. We get them every day from our governments. You want to talk about microaggressions? My local council sends me into microaggressions with every action they do. Do you know what I mean? But we got to stop being tolerant. It's not a time for tolerance. Anybody that tells me it's time for tolerance living in this world right now, they're sicko. They've got to be sick to believe that.
There can be some inspiring ideas from the New Age if you want to dabble in it, but don't get stuck in it. You know, maybe have a look there and gain something.
It's the same as what I was saying before.
Yeah,
it's the same as what I was saying before. It's the same thing. It's like we have sacrifice. We have endurance of the self-sacrifice. They have tolerance of the other people being sacrificed. Do you get what I'm saying? It's almost the same words, right? It's almost the same meaning, but just that slight twist on the word, just a slight twist on the way it is perceived from the human. The way we perceive it changes the action completely to negative or positive. They fly close to the wind. it's easy to get confused. It's easy to think that that's right. So I don't blame the people that do it. Again, I attack the idea. The idea, like this idea that tolerance is going to help us.
Okay, that is the end of this show. There's more audio with Heathen Vegan, but I think I'll keep that for another show. I was thinking of making this a 3-hour show, but I think I will keep the rest and add on to that. So most likely there will be a part 2 to this. I dedicate this show to Nick Spiro. Thank you for listening.